turn to John chapter 4. I just want to look at this passage. I'm sure after this morning's readings, you're all wondering, what on earth is he going to say? I thought, boy, I was choosing some choice passages. But we're going to continue our series on emotionally healthy churches. Obviously, the sort of topics we're going to be touching on and some of the themes that we're going to develop might raise some issues for you. There are a couple of ways that I would encourage you to process the materials that we're doing. First way is to get involved with small groups. And most of our small groups are engaging with this program of study over the next 8 weeks. There are very useful notes and study guides that have various exercises that augment the material and enable you to really engage with what we're doing here on Sundays. For others, that might be a little bit too threatening or uncomfortable. Groups shouldn't be like that, but maybe you feel that they might be. And you might want to talk to individuals one-on-one. And just to say, we have various options in terms of pastoral support. The two principal avenues is Brian Gooding, who's the Director of Pastoral Care. Give us a wave, Brian. This is Brian here. And if you were seeking for pastoral care support, that's one way. The other one is through the Family Life Centre and Kathleen Forbes. And we have a variety of counselling options. Is Kathleen here? I think I saw her this morning. There's Kathleen at the back, just there. And so if there are any issues or you'd like to get further support or whatever, I'd encourage you to speak to these two individuals and they'll be able to point you in the right direction. Or if you don't feel comfortable speaking to them, but you want to talk to some of the other pastors, then please feel free to do that as well. So we're going to continue our study looking at John chapter 4 specifically. Thanks, Shona. We're going to be specifically looking at John chapter 4 and exploring the second part in emotionally healthy churches. This is a course by Pete Cesario. He's from New York. He's a typical New Yorker. And he designed this course several years ago now, and it's been used in various contexts. The premise of the study is that emotional health and spiritual maturity are inseparable. It is not possible to be spiritually mature while remaining emotionally immature. Basically, he's saying that some engagement with our inner life and our emotions and the experiences that have shaped us is required in order to be effective in our following of Jesus Christ. And that to simply ignore and disregard all of this sphere and all of this area is hazardous to us spiritually. The truth is that often, particularly in evangelical conservative circles, there has been a tendency to avoid anything associated with emotions. And we talked a bit about this last week. I won't reiterate that ground. In fact, I would encourage you, if you didn't hear last week's talk, to get it online. All the talks are available. And each one of these talks sort of builds on the other. So, thank you, Shona. To get those online and to look at them. Because each week, as I say, we're going to build on top of what was done. And we recognized last week, and we talked a little bit about how people process emotions and how emotions can generate certain feelings themselves. I knew that when we started this, looking at emotionally healthy churches, that even the title series, I thought, oh boy, this is going to be an issue for some people, because you stick emotional in the front of a study series and people are immediately thinking, well, is this something we want to engage with? This morning we want to look at the first basic principle of emotional health. One of the things I was saying last week was that as children, we're taught about personal hygiene from a very early age. You're taught to brush your teeth, you're taught to wash your hands after you go to the toilet, you're taught to clean your hair. And we teach our children from a very, very young age. We also teach them very quickly to learn how to deal with hurts. So if a child falls and scrapes its knee, You'll often find them rushing into the kitchen or whatever and getting some antiseptic cream and a plaster, or asking for a plaster to be, because they understand this is what you do when you have a hurt. This is how you process it. However, while we teach our children how to process physical pain and physical hurt, we rarely teach people how to healthily process emotional hurt and emotional pain. And so through time, and again to carry the physical analogy on, it's like we have a whole series of hurts and things that are wounded in our souls, which become infected and become septic, and they begin to influence our behaviors. And all sorts of, and sometimes in quite unhealthy ways. Also sometimes in healthy ways. It's strange that some people learn how to take their negative experiences and turn them into very powerful forces for positive behavior, like being successful in business and things like that. But sometimes driven by a deep sense of inferiority or an experience that's happened. Principle one, then, of being healthy emotionally and preparing for discipleship is that we need to learn to look beneath the surfaces. We need to engage with what is there. You see, God is interested in our hearts, deeply interested in our hearts. You'll see that in verse 19 of chapter 4, when the woman is suddenly realizes that Jesus is spiritual. I'll talk about it in a moment, but I don't think from verses 1 to 18 she realized that. But when she realizes that he is a prophet and he is a man of God, she suddenly starts to engage in a conversation about spiritual things. Verse 19, she says, "Sir," the woman said, "I can see that you are a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem." "Woman," Jesus replied, "believe me, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshippers will worship the Father in the Spirit and in truth. For they are the kind of worshippers the Father seeks. God is Spirit, and his worshippers must worship in the Spirit and in truth." What's Jesus saying? What Jesus is saying is that he's saying that God is predominantly interested in our hearts, and that worship has to come out of what is occurring within us. And the whole gist of Jesus' ministry and the heart of his message was that the external forms of religion, that the external practices that define you as good, whether you washed your hands before you started a meal or not, or whether you purified yourself before you went to sacrifice in a sacrificial system, or whatever it was, whether you walked 6 miles on a Sunday or had a bacon roll. He said all of this external stuff does not define us as pure and holy before God. It's actually what's happening inside you. And Christianity wants to speak into our hearts. It wants to address our souls. And Jesus is explaining this. The context in which he's explaining this is actually to do with a debate between the Jews and the Samaritans. Let's turn to the next slide. You won't be probably able to see that. There was a great debate between the Samaritans and the Jews about where Mount Moriah is. You know, in Genesis, in the book of Genesis, Abraham is told to take his son Isaac and to bring him to a mountain called Mount Moriah and sacrifice him there. And you know the story, as Abraham is about to sacrifice Isaac, God says, "Don't do that." And God provides a ram, which is then sacrificed in the place of his son. It's this idea of substitutionary atonement, actually, that's occurring in terms of this. It's not the life of his son, but the ram. And this was the foundation for the sacrificial system of both the Jews and the Samaritans. Now, the Jews built their temple in Jerusalem because they claimed that's where Mount Moriah was. However, the Samaritans built their temple on Mount Gerizim because that's where they believed Abraham had come. Now, they had a debate, and the Samaritans' point was, they said, If you check the text, it says that Abraham traveled for 3 days from Hebron to Mount Moriah. And if I don't know if we can go back. But Hebron's right at the bottom there, and then Jerusalem's the next one up, and you'll see it's very close. Whereas Mount Gerizim is actually 2 more days, and so Jerusalem is only 1 day's journey from Hebron, whereas Mount Gerizim is 3 days' journey from Hebron. And so the Samaritans, and this was their whole case, and so the woman is referring here to this debate. So which mountain do we worship on? Which one is Mount Moriah? Which one is the temple? You can actually still go up onto Mount Gerizim. Let's go. There's a small community of Samaritans up there who live close to what is the remains of a large temple complex. Actually, when Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 CE, what happened was the Romans moved up to a city that's now called Nablus, and they built that city there, and they replaced the temple in Jerusalem with a great big temple, actually on Mount Gerizim, where the Samaritans claimed it was. You can still visit it today and go and see it. And it's also very interesting, if you do go and see it, that when you stand at Jacob's well, and it's almost certainly the well that Jesus referenced, you can actually stand at Jacob's well and see the entire geography of this conversation. So you can actually see the temple up in Mount Gerizim, and you can see the land where Joseph is buried. Joseph's tomb's right beside it. And you, what's for sure is that whoever wrote that story had definitely stood in that spot and seen the geography. Anyway, that's nothing else. Jesus turns around and he says to this whole question, he says to the debate about between the Samaritans and the Jews, he says, no, you're missing the whole point. The whole point is it's not about temples. Okay, I don't know if any of you are all aspiring for the restoration of a third temple or whatever, but I know that the essence of what Christianity was and the essence of the gospel, I invite you to check this out, is that Jesus was saying it is not ultimately about external stuff. And that those who turn it back into external stuff, so it becomes about real estate, or it becomes about restorations of physical temples, or it becomes, it's actually missing the point. Jesus says it's about what's inside you. And it's about purity of heart. It's about what's happening in your soul. And so as Jesus speaks to this woman, he wants her to understand this. Now, we have considerable insights from modern psychology. And modern psychology tell us that our behavior is often governed by our inner life. And there's now lots, over a century of research, in terms of how our inner life shapes our behavior. But our inner life shapes our behavior in all kinds of ways. In fact, the idea that human beings are essentially rational creatures, I think, is seriously challenged in terms of what we see in modern psychology. I was hearing about Nick Clegg's autobiography that he's just published, and apparently the last line of it is, reason will triumph over unreason. I think he was thinking about the EU referendum. But this belief... good, healthy belief that reason will triumph over unreason, that ultimately we are going to be reasonable creatures. Well, I want to suggest to you that actually, sometimes when we present stuff as reason, it hides a host of unreason and irrationality. I mean, today is 9/11, and we remember an event that changed the course of world history, certainly in my lifetime, in terms of the destruction of the Twin Towers. But don't let anybody ever fool you that somehow the decisions on the back of that to invade Afghanistan and Iraq were rationally driven or purely rationally driven decisions. You cannot dissociate the behaviors of the West in relation to Afghanistan and Iraq in terms of the emotions that were generated around the experience of 9/11. There was a correlation. We can debate the extent of that correlation. But if you talk to people and you watch how things were presented, it was presented as rational, as reasonable. I used to think this, and maybe in my retirement, it's another one of these books I need to write. I used to think churches would be rational places. and that human beings are essentially rational, and that basically if you put together good reason and you rational and you argue with people and you reason with people, they will come round and they will see it, and because we operate reasonably. Actually, the book I want to write is called The Irrational Church. Because actually what happens so much in our interactions is not governed by reason. It's governed by irrationality. It's governed by all kinds of stuff that is occurring in terms of our inner lives. And that inner life begins to impact our behavior. The two stories that we talked about actually look at sexual behaviors and experiences. Again, the biblical texts don't explore much our inner lives, because that's a modern thing that we do much more. But it looks at this correlation between how emotions and inner lives and hurts and disappointments, injustices, patterns, how these things actually shape people's sexual behaviors. Oftentimes, when certain things happen sexually in terms of people, there can be an expression of all sorts of things. Sometimes people will behave in patterns that are out of character for them when they have a deep bereavement, when they have a sense of loss, and they will adapt. And in order to offset that, they'll engage in some form of behavior. You'll actually see this quite a lot in individuals as you look at what is governing what people do. But we often dress up our emotions. It's interesting, our artist in residence got this iceberg put up, and often it's a good way of expressing what happens is that we have above the ground, that's what we present to the world, and then we have within ourselves or in our life, which is not what we present to the world. And often that's a big mix. I was talking to Hannah about this, and she was explaining to me that actually this is actually slightly autobiographical in terms of it's a representation of her life. And above her life, she puts things like Christ follower, artist, well-traveled, open to ideas, experienced. And then below the line, you'll find negative things like filled with doubt, self-righteousness, other things. And she told me she painted some others of them out as well. And it's interesting how that's exactly our experience, that we present one thing to the world, but actually underneath there is a whole host of stuff that is going on. I would suggest that Jesus' teaching addresses this an awful lot. Look at the Sermon on the Mount, the way that Jesus talks about our inner lives. And actually, again, moves it from external behaviors actually into what is happening in our inner lives. And affirming that God is very interested in this. I also find it interesting that one of the ways that we are taught to process emotion, and most of us think of contemporary counseling models, but actually, the Christian church and Christian traditions actually also provided a way of dealing with all of this stuff. People need rituals, for instance, to deal with emotion. If you think about what happened in Nice a few weeks back, and I had just been there a couple of weeks before, that van drove along the promenade. I'd actually walked along that promenade, and so it was very close to home when I saw that happening. But when a disaster like that strikes a community, the community don't generally look for somebody to explain why a God of love allows suffering in the world. And they don't want a wee lecture on, well, this is why this happened, and this is how this can happen, and this is how the innocent can suffer. Okay? They don't want that. What they want is some kind of ritual to help them process their loss and their grief. They want, you know, to be able to light candles. They want to be able to bring flowers. They want some tangible ritual that allows them to process what is happening in their inner lives. Again, as Protestant evangelicals, we have missed out to a large extent in our reaction in the Reformation to this very important fact. But ritual is important. In saying that, actually, even as evangelical conservative Christians, we also have rituals. One of the reasons I think you should come to church every Sunday isn't so you can listen to my sermons, But actually, bringing pattern into your life is healthy for you. It's healthy for your inner life. Getting up and reading the scriptures in the morning or at night before you go to bed is healthy because it's a pattern. Praying and processing stuff is healthy because it is a pattern. One of the really important disciplines in the Christian life is the idea of confession. Confession is actually where we look at those areas in our lives that are below the surface, the stuff that we really don't want to face, and we confess it. Confess means to say the same as. But we say, God, you know, I recognize that maybe I am full of pride here. God, I recognize that there's fear here. God, I recognize that there are inappropriate motives here. And we confess those things. I find it fascinating that as confession, in the face of we're all basically good people and we never face anything negative below the line, as that has gone out of fashion in the church and Christianity, in the psychological realm, the whole idea of counseling has come up and increased. But actually, we had a ritual that was there that helped us process some of the stuff. Because we're invited to actually look at what is going on in our hearts and confess them before God. That's what we're invited to do. And all of us should be doing this on a daily basis. Looking at, God, what is happening in my heart? Now, sometimes, and again, modern psychology tells us this, we find it very difficult to face the reality of what is happening in our lives. If you go and do something really, really bad, you can go into a state of dissonance where in order to rationalize what you're doing, you affirm that you're profoundly good because you can't actually sit and face the truth about what you have just done and what you are doing. Again, you will sometimes see this if you look at studies of murderers or things in the press. In fact, there was one this week where you look at what people do and you think, how can they do that? Well, they can do that by just basically ignoring the emotions and the realities. Sometimes people aren't ever aware of actually what's happening in their hearts. And that the reason they're behaving in that way is because they have a hurt. And that it's a hurt that's even too deep to face or too deep to grapple with. And so when they come to confession, they'll recognize maybe superficial stuff, although some of us find it really hard to even recognize that nowadays. But they won't grapple with even deeper stuff. I think this woman at the well had a lot of issues. I think there was an awful lot of deep stuff occurring in this woman's life. How did she get to know or see what was happening in terms of our lives? Well, we see it in terms of patterns. And this is one of the ways, let's go to the next slide. This is one of the ways that often we learn that maybe there's stuff below the surface that's influencing us and shaping us that's affecting what's happening up here. Maybe there's stuff in our lives. I find it very interesting that in terms of sexual patterns and sexual behaviors now, that in some realms we're never ever even allowed to suggest that maybe emotional experiences or hurts can shape your sexual behavior patterns. Certain areas that's now considered inappropriate, but actually it's fundamental. Think about it. Think about what happens. At a fairly mundane level, we know that if somebody's under high stress, it usually affects the libido. And the libido will drop. There's a direct correlation between behavior and what's actually happening in terms of your inner life. How do we learn what are some of these deeper stuff, some of this stuff that we don't even recognize or sometimes can't face? It's often through the patterns that we see being repeated in our lives. You know, and a repeating cycle of pattern. Failed relationships is a good instance where people just fail at relationships over and over again. Maybe some of you know individuals where it's just like every time life starts to go well for them or they start to find a relationship that's positive and healthy, suddenly they do something to sabotage it. And you feel like shaking them and going, what's wrong with you? This was really good. This was positive. This was healthy. Why did you blow up? And then you watch them doing this 3 or 4 times, and then you just give up. And you're like, that's how it's going to be. But I guarantee that when that's happening and when there's repeating cycles, there's something beneath the surface. Maybe a belief that I'm always going to be a failure. And somewhere maybe in their life or their experience, they had been told that, or they had something that made them think that. And so there's a deep-seated belief that I will always be a failure. And so when they come to things and they look like they're going to succeed and it's going to present a different reality to them, what they'll do is they'll blow the thing up. And they'll say, see, I'm a failure. And so the inner voice and the outer voice are reaffirmed. Sometimes people think they're bad. And that somehow they're beyond redemption. And again, their behaviors will reflect that belief. You know, there was once a discussion in a movie between a fundamentalist preacher and a prostitute. And she said, you know, you and I have exactly the same view of me. And he went, what do you mean? And she said, I won't use the actual word, but she said, you think I'm rubbish, and I think I'm rubbish as well. You know, I'm rubbish. That's why I'm here. Some people think that they're fundamentally unlikable. Nobody's ever going to like me. And again, they find self-fulfilling outworking of these things in their lives. Repeating cycles. In your life, and again, this is one of the studies that's really helpful in the emotionally healthy church, is it helps you look at repeating cycles. Interestingly enough, Pete Cesario, and I did this exercise and I found it profoundly helpful, actually goes beyond your own personal life and actually looks at your whole entire family life. You know that sometimes, and it's fascinating, but in families there are repeating cycles. Cycles repeat. And so one generation blows it in a particular way, and then the next generation blows it in a particular way. And even then the next generation, and you can watch it. That's amazing. There's something repeating here. Carl Jung, the psychologist, he said, you know, we turn into the things that we hate. And again, you sometimes see this. Someone who has an alcoholic father who's abusive towards them, and they hate it and they despise it. And what do? They turn into an alcoholic father who abuses, a pattern that repeats. And so we are invited to look at the patterns. Here in this woman, there was a repeating pattern. I actually think, and again, this is my read, no commentary advocates this, but I do, and I think it's pretty good, that there is a repeating pattern here. I actually think that the woman on the well is hitting on Jesus, okay? And you see the reasons for this as I go through it, but basically the dialogue opens with the woman saying, why are you talking to me? Now, you think about this, you're in the woman's head. Why is this man talking to me? Jesus has approached her and he said, give me a drink. And she's saying, why are you talking to me? You know, you're a Jew, I'm a Samaritan. And we're at a well. And by the way, wells, you need to understand, wells are where you go to pick people up in the ancient world. You read your Old Testaments, you know, if Jacob or Isaac was looking for a bride, they'd send them to the well to pick up the attractive girls, because that's where you met girls. So it's like a nightclub. So she says, why are you talking to me? You're a Samaritan. And it finishes with a very interesting line where he says, go and get your husband. And she says, I'm not married. Okay. And let's look at how that dialogue unravels. So it starts with, why are you talking to me? And he said, well, if you understood who I am, you would be asking me for a drink. Right? Now, in Glasgow, we would call this banter, would we not? This looks like banter to me. What's she thinking? This guy's a bit full of himself. You know, he starts by giving me a drink, but if you knew who I was, you'd be asking me for a drink. And then she replies, and again, I think this shows us a lot about who Jesus is, okay? Because I think she's having fun. She's responding in banter with Jesus. Again, something that movies and portrayals of Jesus fail to engage with. She says, but you've got no cup. You know, how are you going to do this? Are you really greater than Jacob? That's a fun response to what Jesus has just said. And Jesus says, Drink and you will never be thirsty again. Drink from the water that I give you and you will never be thirsty again. A brilliant, profound spiritual truth. And again, John often does this. He shows that profound spiritual truths are misunderstood. I think this profound spiritual truth is being misunderstood. She's kind of thinking, wow, he's really arrogant here. So she turns to him and says, well, all right, give me this water then. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, just show me. And Jesus says, get your husband. Okay. And she says, I have no husband. Why she lied? You know, why do that? Why say, and she's basically saying, I'm single. Fascinating life. Why give us that life at the end of this banter? Oh, I've got no husband. I'm free. I'm available. I think she's repeating her pattern. I think she's just caught in this pattern. And what does Jesus do at this point? Jesus recognizes what is happening and he turns to her and he says, you're right, you've had five husbands and the guy you're living with at the moment isn't your husband. You know, and he confronts her in terms of the pattern. He also confronts her in terms of what she's just been doing and how she's been relating to Christ. Now, interestingly enough, she immediately defaults to religious conversations. Okay? Now, I share personal experiences, but sometimes when people have been interacting with me, maybe at the gym and things, and they don't realize I'm a minister, they'll be swearing away, they'll be talking about all sorts of things probably they shouldn't be talking about, and then suddenly they discover I'm a minister, and immediately the conversation will change and they'll say something religious. You know, this happens, tell me, that's what happened here. Suddenly she turns to this big question about Mount Moriah because she was embarrassed. Yet what had Jesus done? He had identified the pattern and invited her to recognize the pattern. You see, naming a thing is very powerful and actually is the first step that we have in terms of finding emotional health. Actually seeing what is going on in terms of our behavior. Actually recognizing something that is driving this. Again, both psychologically this is a very powerful thing, but also in terms of confession. Because confession invites us to recognize what's happening in our hearts and to name a thing. Interestingly, when we name emotions, it's actually seen as a way of beginning to take dominion over the emotion. We're facing a reality. I remember I did a counseling diploma many, many years ago, and we were looking at the various forms of counseling that go on, and there was one called Gestalt, I think that's how you say it, which basically meant you just insulted people. And so somebody shared with you, you know, their heart and how everything was falling apart, and you just say, get your act together, what's wrong with you, stop ignoring your responsibilities. I better not say, I can see which country it came from, but you know, vroom, I wasn't really that keen on that one, although I quite like doing it, but anyway, Jesus has done a very confrontational thing. I would not recommend necessarily that you do this. But he has confronted her in terms of the pattern. And she's invited to recognize the pattern that's going on there. Now, here's the thing. She walks away from that encounter and goes and tells everybody about Jesus. Now, here, I used to think, and in fact, when I came to this text, I was kind of had it mentally in my head, that Jesus, somewhere in this conversation, says to the woman, don't go away, go away and sin no more. I kind of thought, that must be in that text somewhere. Okay? And then I reread it, and actually, you know something? He never says it. He never says it. The woman goes away and affirms, and I'll tell you what happens here, is that she goes and says, I have met the Messiah. Because in the midst of recognizing the pattern, recognizing the things that were happening in her life, recognizing the stuff that is below the surface, Jesus has turned around and he has affirmed his acceptance offer. He hasn't rejected her, but he's affirmed that acceptance. He knew who she was and accepted her. You see, here's the essence of Christianity. In the midst of all of that dark stuff, God says, I love you and I died for you and I affirm my acceptance of you. I think this is brilliantly understood in the story of Tamar and Judah that we read. It's something that could come out of a soap opera, all about the misogynistic world that we often inhabit, the double standards at the end. Judas sleeps with a shrine prostitute, and then he thinks his daughter-in-law has done the same, and he demands that she be burnt. You go, what? Some people would say that's the way it works, isn't it? And here's this woman who has been cheated over and over again. The law said that because her husband died, she should be given a child so that she could inherit the property. And the second son, Oman, has refused to do that. And he had died. And then Judah thought she was possessed or something, and he wasn't going to. So he palmed her off and thought he could forget about her. And Judah was driven to the point, in order to receive her inheritance, to actually dressing up as a prostitute, a shrine prostitute no less. So Judah was actually entering an area and sleeping with the local gods' representatives, or thought so he thought. And she takes his staff and his signet ring and says, "Send me the goat for payment." But when it's announced he's pregnant, confronts Judah. Interestingly, in rabbinic law, they think that when Judah says, you know, she's more righteous than I am, that was confession. And he was recognizing what he had done. Now, that story is highly dysfunctional. It's a story that, although it's not a million miles away from the sort of things that actually happens in our day and age, maybe not in the same way, but it's highly dysfunctional, highly broken. You know, and you think, what's this even doing in the Bible? But here's the shocker. If you turn to the genealogy of Jesus, you will discover, in Matthew's Gospel, you will discover the name of Tamar. Judah and the descendants of Jesus from Judah follow the line of Tamar. You see, I think it's showing us that we have a God who, in the midst of our brokenness, in the midst of the mixed emotions and dysfunctional things that we do because of the hurts and the pain that we have in our life, nevertheless affirms his acceptance of us and the possibility that he can bring good from what is bad. He can bring healing from what is hurt. That's the God that we believe in, the God of Tamar. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, I just thank you for the stories that we've read. Lord, and we thank you for the lessons and things that we learn from these stories. And God, I just pray that you would help us maybe to recognize those patterns in our lives, to recognize those things that seem to be repeating, and maybe we don't even understand why, but to recognize the hurt and the pain. Lord, I pray that those things that need to be confessed in our lives, that you would help us to confess those things and learn this discipline of recognizing our inner lives and some of the wrong things that occur in those inner lives. But Lord, we thank you most of all that in the midst of our brokenness, you're a God who loves and accepts us. I thank you for this. Amen.